Disc 17.
Chapter 53. Mr. Bulstrode, when he was hoping to acquire a new interest in Lowick, had naturally had an especial wish that the new clergyman should be one whom he thoroughly approved, and he believed it to be a chastisement and admonition directed to his own shortcomings and those of the nation at large, that just about the time when he came in possession of the deeds which made him the proprietor of Stone Court, Mr. Fairbrother read himself into the quaint little church and preached his first sermon to the congregation of farmers, labourers, and village artisans. It was not that Mr. Bulstrode intended to frequent Lowick Church or to reside at Stone Court for a good while to come. He had bought the excellent farm and fine homestead simply as a retreat, which he might gradually enlarge as to the land and beautify as to the dwelling, until it should be conducive to the divine glory that he should enter on it as a residence, partially withdrawing from his present exertions in the administration of business, and throwing more conspicuously on the side of gospel truth the weight of local landed proprietorship, which Providence might increase by unforeseen occasions of purchase. A strong leading in this direction seemed to have been given in the surprising facility of getting Stone Court, when everyone had expected that Mr. Rigg Featherstone would have clung to it as the Garden of Eden. That was what poor old Peter himself had expected, having often in imagination looked up through the sods above him and, unobstructed by perspective, seen his frog-faced legatee enjoying the fine old place to the perpetual surprise and disappointment of other survivors. But how little we know what would make paradise for our neighbours. We judge from our own desires, and our neighbours themselves are not always open enough even to throw out a hint of theirs. The cool and judicious Joshua Rigg had not allowed his parent to perceive that Stone Court was anything less than the chief good in his estimation, and he had certainly wished to call it his own. But, as Warren Hastings looked at gold and thought of buying Daylesford, so Joshua Rigg looked at Stone Court and thought of buying gold. He had a very distinct and intense vision of his chief good, the vigorous greed which he had inherited having taken a special form by dint of circumstance, and his chief good was to be a money changer. From his earliest employment as an errand boy in a seaport, he had looked through the windows of the money changers as other boys look through the windows of the pastry cooks. The fascination had wrought itself gradually into a deep, special passion. He meant, when he had property, to do many things, one of them being to marry a genteel young person, but these were all accidents and joys that imagination could dispense with. The one joy after which his soul thirsted was to have a money changer's shop on a much frequented quay, to have locks all round him of which he held the keys, and to look sublimely cool as he handled the breeding coins of all nations, while helpless cupidity looked at him enviously from the other side of an iron lattice. The strength of that passion had been a power enabling him to master all the knowledge necessary to gratify it, and when others were thinking that he had settled at Stone Court for life, Joshua himself was thinking that the moment now was not far off when he should settle on the North Quay with the best appointments in safes and locks. Enough. We are concerned with looking at Joshua Rigg's sale of his land from Mr. Bulstrode's point of view, and he interpreted it as a cheering dispensation, conveying perhaps a sanction to a purpose which he had for some time entertained without external encouragement. He interpreted it thus, but not too confidently, offering up his thanksgiving in guarded phraseology. His doubts did not arise from the possible relations of the event to Joshua Rigg's destiny, which belonged to the unmapped regions not taken under the providential government, except perhaps in an imperfect colonial way. But they arose from reflecting that this dispensation too might be a chastisement for himself, as Mr. Fairbrother's induction to the living clearly was. This was not what Mr. Bulstrode said to any man for the sake of deceiving him, it was what he said to himself. It was as genuinely his mode of explaining events as any theory of yours may be if you happen to disagree with him. For the egoism which enters into our theories does not affect their sincerity. Rather, the more our egoism is satisfied, the more robust is our belief. However, whether for sanction or for chastisement, Mr. Bulstrode, hardly 15 months after the death of Peter Featherstone, had become the proprietor of Stone Court. and what Peter would say, if he were worthy to know, had become an inexhaustible and consolatory subject of conversation to his disappointed relatives. The tables were now turned on that dear brother departed, and to contemplate the frustration of his cunning by the superior cunning of things in general was a cud of delight to Solomon. Mrs. Wall had a melancholy triumph in the proof that it did not answer to make false Featherstones and cut off the genuine. And Sister Martha, receiving the news in the chalky flats, said, "Dear, dear, then the Almighty could have been none so pleased with the almshouses after all." Affectionate Mrs. Bulstrode was particularly glad of the advantage which her husband's health was likely to get from the purchase of Stone Court. Few days passed without his riding thither and looking over some part of the farm with the bailiff, and the evenings were delicious in that quiet spot, when the new hayricks lately set up were sending forth odours to mingle with the breath of the rich old garden. One evening, while the sun was still above the horizon and burning in golden lamps among the great walnut boughs, Mr. Bulstrode was pausing on horseback outside the front gate waiting for Caleb Garth, who had met him by appointment to give an opinion on a question of stable drainage and was now advising the bailiff in the rickyard. Mr. Bulstrode was conscious of being in a good spiritual frame and more than usually serene under the influence of his innocent recreation. He was doctrinally convinced that there was a total absence of merit in himself, but that doctrinal conviction may be held without pain when the sense of demerit does not take a distinct shape in memory and revive the tingling of shame or the pang of remorse. Nay, it may be held with intense satisfaction when the depth of our sinning is but a measure for the depth of forgiveness, and clenching proof that we are peculiar instruments of the divine intention. The memory has as many moods as the temper, and shifts its scenery like a diorama. At this moment, Mr. Bulstrode felt as if the sunshine were all one with that of far-off evenings when he was a very young man and used to go out preaching beyond Highbury. And he would willingly have had that service of exhortation in prospect now. The texts were there still, and so was his own facility in expounding them. His brief reverie was interrupted by the return of Caleb Garth, who also was on horseback, and was just shaking his bridle before starting when he exclaimed, "Bless my heart! What's this fellow in black coming along the lane? He's like one of those men one sees about after the races." Mr. Bulstrode turned his horse and looked along the lane, but made no reply. The comer was our slight acquaintance, Mr. Raffles, whose appearance presented no other change than such as was due to a suit of black and a crape hatband. He was within 3 yards of the horsemen now, and they could see the flash of recognition in his face as he whirled his stick upward, looking all the while at Mr. Bulstrode, and at last exclaiming, "By Jove, Nick, it's you! I couldn't be mistaken, though the 25 years have played old bogey with us both. How are you, eh? You didn't expect to see me here. Come, shake us by the hand." To say that Mr. Raffles' manner was rather excited would be only one mode of saying that it was evening. Caleb Garth could see that there was a moment of struggle and hesitation in Mr. Bulstrode, but it ended in his putting out his hand coldly to Raffles and saying,
"I did not indeed expect to see you in this remote country place."
"Well, it belongs to a stepson of mine," said Raffles, adjusting himself in a swaggering attitude. "I came to see him here before. I'm not so surprised at seeing you, old fellow, because I picked up a letter, what you may call a providential thing. It's uncommonly fortunate I met you, though, for I don't care about seeing my stepson. He's not affectionate, and his poor mother's gone now. To tell the truth, I came out of love to you, Nick. I came to get your address, for... look here."
Raffles drew a crumpled paper from his pocket. Almost any other man than Caleb Garth might have been tempted to linger on the spot for the sake of hearing all he could about a man whose acquaintance with Bulstrode seemed to imply passages in the banker's life so unlike anything that was known of him in Middlemarch that they must have the nature of a secret to pique curiosity. But Caleb was peculiar. Certain human tendencies which are commonly strong were almost absent from his mind, and one of these was curiosity about personal affairs. Especially if there was anything discreditable to be found out concerning another man, Caleb preferred not to know it, and if he had to tell anybody under him that his evil doings were discovered, he was more embarrassed than the culprit. He now spurred his horse, and saying, "I wish you good evening, Mr. Bulstrode, I must be getting home," set off at a trot.
"You didn't put your full address to this letter," Raffles continued. "That was not like the first-rate man of business you used to be." "The shrubs! They may be anywhere. You live near at hand, eh? Have cut the London concern altogether. Perhaps turned country squire. Have a rural mansion to invite me to. Lord, how many years it is ago! The old lady must have been dead a pretty long while. Gone to glory without the pain of knowing how poor her daughter was, eh? But, by Jove, you're very pale and pasty, Nick. Come, if you're going home, I'll walk by your side."
Mr. Bulstrode's usual paleness had in fact taken an almost deathly hue. 5 minutes before, the expanse of his life had been submerged in its evening sunshine, which shone backward to its remembered morning. Sin seemed to be a question of doctrine and inward penitence, humiliation an exercise of the closet, the bearing of his deeds a matter of private vision, adjusted solely by spiritual relations and conceptions of the divine purposes. And now, as if by some hideous magic, this loud red figure had risen before him in unmanageable solidity, an incorporate past which had not entered into his imagination of chastisements. But Mr. Bulstrode's thought was busy, and he was not a man to act or speak rashly.
"I was going home," he said, "but I can defer my ride a little, and you can, if you please, rest here."
"Thank you," said Raffles, making a grimace. "I don't care now about seeing my stepson. I'd rather go home with you."
"Your stepson, if Mr. Rigg Featherstone was he, is here no longer. I am master here now."
Raffles opened wide eyes and gave a long whistle of surprise before he said,
"Well, then, I've no objection. I've had enough walking from the coach road. I never was much of a walker or rider either. What I like is a smart vehicle and a spirited cob. I was always a little heavy in the saddle. What a pleasant surprise it must be to you to see me, old fellow," he continued, as they turned towards the house.
"You don't say so.
But you never took your luck heartily. You were always thinking of improving the occasion. You'd such a gift for improving your luck."
Mr. Raffles seemed greatly to enjoy his own wit, and swung his leg in a swaggering manner which was rather too much for his companion's judicious patience.
"If I remember rightly," Mr. Bulstrode observed with chill anger, "our acquaintance many years ago had not the sort of intimacy which you are now assuming, Mr. Raffles. Any services you desire of me will be the more readily rendered if you will avoid a tone of familiarity which did not lie in our former intercourse, and can hardly be warranted by more than 20 years of separation." "You don't like being called Nick? Why, I always called you Nick in my heart, and though lost to sight, to memory dear. By Jove, my feelings have ripened for you like fine old cognac. I hope you've got some in the house now. Josh filled my flask well the last time."
Mr. Bulstrode had not yet fully learned that even the desire for cognac was not stronger in Raffles than the desire to torment, and that a hint of annoyance always served him as a fresh cue. But it was at least clear that further objection was useless, and Mr. Bulstrode, in giving orders to the housekeeper for the accommodation to the guest, had a resolute air of quietude. There was the comfort of thinking that this housekeeper had been in the service of Rigg also, and might accept the idea that Mr. Bulstrode entertained Raffles merely as a friend of her former master. When there was food and drink spread before his visitor in the wainscoted parlour, and no witness in the room, Mr. Bulstrode said,
"Your habits and mine are so different, Mr. Raffles, that we can hardly enjoy each other's society. The wisest plan for both of us will therefore be to part as soon as possible. Since you say that you wished to meet me, you probably considered that you had some business to transact with me. But under the circumstances, I will invite you to remain here for the night, and I will myself ride over here early tomorrow morning, before breakfast, in fact, when I can receive any communication you have to make to me."
"With all my heart," said Raffles. This is a comfortable place. A little dull for a continuance, but I can put up with it for a night, with this good liquor and the prospect of seeing you again in the morning. You're a much better host than my stepson was. But Josh owed me a bit of a grudge for marrying his mother, and between you and me there was never anything but kindness.
Mr. Bulstrode, hoping that the peculiar mixture of joviality and sneering in Raffles' manner was a good deal the effect of drink, had determined to wait till he was quite sober before he spent more words upon him. But he rode home with a terribly lucid vision of the difficulty there would be in arranging any result that could be permanently counted on with this man. It was inevitable that he should wish to get rid of John Raffles, though his reappearance could not be regarded as lying outside the divine plan. The spirit of evil might have sent him to threaten Mr. Bulstrode's subversion as an instrument of good. But the threat must have been permitted, and was a chastisement of a new kind. It was an hour of anguish for him, very different from the hours in which his struggle had been securely private, and which had ended with a sense that his secret misdeeds were pardoned and his services accepted. Those misdeeds, even when committed, had they not been half sanctified by the singleness of his desire to devote himself and all he possessed to the furtherance of the divine scheme? And was he, after all, to become a mere stone of stumbling and a rock of offence? For who would understand the work within him? Who would not, when there was the pretext of casting disgrace upon him, confound his whole life and the truths he had espoused in one heap of obloquy? In his closest meditations, the lifelong habit of Mr. Bulstrode's mind clad his most egoistic terrors in doctrinal references to superhuman ends. But even while we are talking and meditating about the Earth's orbit and the solar system, what we feel and adjust our movements to is the stable Earth and the changing day. And now, within all the automatic succession of theoretic phrases, distinct and inmost as the shiver and the ache of oncoming fever when we are discussing abstract pain, was the forecast of disgrace in the presence of his neighbours and of his own wife. For the pain, as well as the public estimate of disgrace, depends on the amount of previous profession. To men who only aim at escaping felony, nothing short of the prisoner's dock is disgrace. But Mr. Bulstrode had aimed at being an eminent Christian. It was not more than 7:30 in the morning when he again reached Stone Court. The fine old place never looked more like a delightful home than at that moment. The great white lilies were in flower. The nasturtiums, their pretty leaves all silvered with dew, were running away over the low stone wall. The very noises all around had a heart of peace within them. But everything was spoiled for the owner as he walked on the gravel in front and awaited the descent of Mr. Raffles, with whom he was condemned to breakfast. It was not long before they were seated together in the wainscoted parlour over their tea and toast, which was as much as Raffles cared to take at that early hour. The difference between his morning and evening self was not so great as his companion had imagined that it might be. The delight in tormenting was perhaps even the stronger, because his spirits were rather less highly pitched. Certainly his manners seemed more disagreeable by the morning light.
"As I have little time to spare, Mr. Raffles," said the banker, who could hardly do more than sip his tea and break his toast without eating it, "I shall be obliged if you will mention at once the ground on which you wished to meet with me. I presume that you have a home elsewhere and will be glad to return to it."
"Why, if a man has got any heart, doesn't he want to see an old friend, Nick? I must call you Nick. We always did call you young Nick when we knew you meant to marry the old widow. Some said you had a handsome family likeness to old Nick.
But that was your mother's fault, calling you Nicholas.
Aren't you glad to see me again? I expected an invite to stay with you at some pretty place. My own establishment is broken up now my wife's dead. I have no particular attachment to any spot. I would as soon settle hereabout as anywhere."
"May I ask why you returned from America? I considered that the strong wish you expressed to go there, when an adequate sum was furnished, was tantamount to an engagement that you would remain there for life."
"Never knew that a wish to go to a place was the same thing as a wish to stay. But I did stay a matter of 10 years. It didn't suit me to stay any longer. And I'm not going again, Nick."
Here Mr. Raffles winked slowly as he looked at Mr. Bulstrode.
Do you wish to be settled in any business? What is your calling now?
Thank you. My calling is to enjoy myself as much as I can. I don't care about working any more. If I did anything, it would be a little travelling in the tobacco line or something of that sort, which takes a man into agreeable company, but not without an independence to fall back upon. That's what I want. I'm not so strong as I was, Nick. Though I've got more colour than you, I want an independence.
That could be supplied to you if you would engage to keep at a distance, said Mr. Bulstrode, perhaps with a little too much eagerness in his undertone.
That must be as it suits my convenience, said Raffles coolly. I see no reason why I shouldn't make a few acquaintances hereabout. I am not ashamed of myself as company for anybody. I dropped my portmanteau at the turnpike when I got down. Change of linen. Genuine. Honour bright. More than fronts and wristbands. And with this suit of mourning, straps and everything, I should do you credit among the nobs here.
Mr. Raffles had pushed away his chair and looked down at himself, particularly at his straps. His chief intention was to annoy Bulstrode, but he really thought that his appearance now would produce a good effect, and that he was not only handsome and witty, but clad in a mourning style which implied solid connections.
"If you intend to rely on me in any way, Mr. Raffles," said Bulstrode after a moment's pause, "you will expect to meet my wishes."
"Ah, to be sure," said Raffles with a mocking cordiality. "Didn't I always do it? Lord, you made a pretty thing out of me, and I got but little. I've often thought since I might have done better by telling the old woman that I'd found her daughter and her grandchild. It would have suited my feelings better. I've got a soft place in my heart. But you've buried the old lady by this time, I suppose. It's all one to her now. And you've got your fortune out of that profitable business which had such a blessing on it. You've taken to being a nob, buying land, being a country bashaw. Still in the dissenting line, eh? Still godly? Or taken to the church as more genteel?"
This time Mr. Raffles' slow wink and slight protrusion of his tongue was worse than a nightmare, because it held the certitude that it was not a nightmare, but a waking misery. Mr. Bulstrode felt a shuddering nausea and did not speak, but was considering diligently whether he should not leave Raffles to do as he would and simply defy him as a slanderer. The man would soon show himself disreputable enough to make people disbelieve him. "But not when he tells any ugly-looking truth about you," said discerning consciousness. And again, it seemed no wrong to keep Raffles at a distance, but Mr. Bulstrode shrank from the direct falsehood of denying true statements. It was one thing to look back on forgiven sins, nay, to explain questionable conformity to lax customs, and another to enter deliberately on the necessity of falsehood. But since Bulstrode did not speak, Raffles ran on by way of using time to the utmost.
"I've not had such fine luck as you, by Jove. Things went confoundedly with me in New York. Those Yankees are cool hands, and a man of gentlemanly feelings has no chance with them. I married when I came back, a nice woman in the tobacco trade, very fond of me, but the trade was restricted, as we say. She had been settled there a good many years by a friend, but there was a son too much in the case. Josh and I never hit it off. However, I made the most of the position, and I've always taken my glass in good company. It's been all on the square with me. I'm as open as the day. You won't take it ill of me that I didn't look you up before. I've got a complaint that makes me a little dilatory. I thought you were trading and praying away in London still, and didn't find you there. But you see, I was sent to you, Nick, perhaps for a blessing to both of us."
Mr. Raffles ended with a jocose snuffle. No man felt his intellect more superior to religious cant, and if the cunning which calculates on the meanest feelings in men could be called intellect, he had his share. For under the blurting, rallying tone with which he spoke to Bulstrode, there was an evident selection of statements, as if they had been so many moves at chess. Meanwhile, Bulstrode had determined on his move, and he said with gathered resolution,
You will do well to reflect, Mr. Raffles, that it is possible for a man to overreach himself in the effort to secure undue advantage. Although I am not in any way bound to you, I am willing to supply you with a regular annuity in quarterly payments, so long as you fulfill a promise to remain at a distance from this neighbourhood. It is in your power to choose. If you insist on remaining here even for a short time, you will get nothing from me. I shall decline to know you.
Ha, ha, said Raffles, with an affected explosion. That reminds me of a droll dog of a thief who declined to know the constable.
Your allusions are lost on me, sir, said Bulstrode with white heat. The law has no hold on me, either through your agency or any other.
You can't understand a joke, my good fellow. I only meant that I should never decline to know you. But let us be serious. Your quarterly payment won't quite suit me. I like my freedom.
Here Raffles rose and stalked once or twice up and down the room, swinging his leg and assuming an air of masterly meditation. At last he stopped opposite Bulstrode and said,
I'll tell you what. Give us a couple of hundreds. Come, that's modest. And I'll go away, honour bright, pick up my portmanteau and go away. But I shall not give up my liberty for a dirty annuity. I shall come and go where I like. Perhaps it may suit me to stay away and correspond with a friend. Perhaps not. Have you the money with you?
No, I have 100, said Bulstrode, feeling the immediate riddance too great a relief to be rejected on the ground of future uncertainties. I will forward you the other if you will mention an address.
No, I'll wait here till you bring it, said Raffles. I'll take a stroll and have a snack, and you'll be back by that time.
Mr. Bulstrode's sickly body, shattered by the agitations he had gone through since the last evening, made him feel abjectly in the power of this loud, invulnerable man. At that moment he snatched at a temporary repose to be won on any terms. He was rising to do what Raffles suggested, when the latter said, lifting up his finger as if with a sudden recollection,
"I did have another look after Sarah again, though I didn't tell you. I'd a tender conscience about that pretty young woman. I didn't find her, but I found out her husband's name, and I made a note of it. But hang it, I lost my pocketbook. However, if I heard it, I should know it again." I've got my faculties as if I was in my prime, but names wear out, by Jove. Sometimes I'm no better than a confounded tax paper before the names are filled in. However, if I hear of her and her family, you shall know, Nick. You'd like to do something for her now she's your stepdaughter.
Doubtless, said Mr. Bulstrode with the usual steady look of his light grey eyes, though that might reduce my power of assisting you.
As he walked out of the room, Raffles winked slowly at his back, and then turned towards the window to watch the banker riding away, virtually at his command. His lips first curled with a smile, and then opened with a short, triumphant laugh.
"But what the deuce was the name?" he presently said,
half aloud, scratching his head and wrinkling his brows horizontally. He had not really cared or thought about this point of forgetfulness until it occurred to him in his invention of annoyances for Bulstrode.
"It began with L. It was almost all L's, I fancy," he went on, with a sense that he was getting hold of the slippery name.
But the hold was too slight, and he soon got tired of this mental chase, for few men were more impatient of private occupation or more in need of making themselves continually heard than Mr. Raffles. He preferred using his time in pleasant conversation with the bailiff and the housekeeper, from whom he gathered as much as he wanted to know about Mr. Bulstrode's position in Middlemarch. After all, however, there was a dull space of time which needed relieving with bread and cheese and ale, and when he was seated alone with these resources in the wainscoted parlour, he suddenly slapped his knee and exclaimed, "Ladislaw!" That action of memory which he had tried to set going and had abandoned in despair had suddenly completed itself without conscious effort. A common experience, agreeable as a completed sneeze, even if the name remembered is of no value. Raffles immediately took out his pocketbook and wrote down the name, not because he expected to use it, but merely for the sake of not being at a loss if he ever did happen to want it. He was not going to tell Bulstrode. There was no actual good in telling. And to a mind like that of Mr. Raffles, there is always probable good in a secret. He was satisfied with his present success, and by 3 o'clock that day he had taken up his portmanteau at the turnpike and mounted the coach, relieving Mr. Bulstrode's eyes of an ugly black spot on the landscape at Stone Court, but not relieving him of the dread that the black spot might reappear and become inseparable even from the vision of his hearth. Book 6. The Widow and the Wife. Chapter 54. By that delightful morning when the hayricks at Stone Court were scenting the air quite impartially, as if Mr. Raffles had been a guest worthy of finest incense, Dorothea had again taken up her abode at Lowick Manor. After 3 months, Freshett had become rather oppressive. To sit like a model for St. Catherine, looking rapturously at Celia's baby, would not do for many hours in the day, and to remain in that momentous babe's presence with persistent disregard was a course that could not have been tolerated in a childless sister. Dorothea would have been capable of carrying baby joyfully for a mile if there had been need, and of loving it the more tenderly for that labour. But to an aunt who does not recognise her infant nephew as Buddha, and has nothing to do for him but to admire, his behaviour is apt to appear monotonous, and the interest of watching him, exhaustible. This possibility was quite hidden from Celia, who felt that Dorothea's childless widowhood fell in quite prettily with the birth of little Arthur. Baby was named after Mr. Brooke.
"Dodo is just the creature not to mind about having anything of her own, children or anything," said Celia to her husband. "And if she had had a baby, it could never have been such a dear as Arthur, could it, James?"
"Not if it had been like Casaubon," said Sir James, conscious of some indirectness in his answer, and of holding a strictly private opinion as to the perfections of his firstborn.
"No, just imagine. Really, it was a mercy," said Celia. "And I think it is very nice for Dodo to be a widow. She can be just as fond of our baby as if it were her own, and she can have as many notions of her own as she likes."
"It is a pity she was not a queen," said the devout Sir James.
"But what should we have been then? We must have been something else," said Celia, objecting to so laborious a flight of imagination. "I like her better as she is."
Hence, when she found that Dorothea was making arrangements for her final departure to Lowick, Celia raised her eyebrows with disappointment, and in her quiet, unemphatic way, shot a needle arrow of sarcasm.
"What will you do at Lowick, Dodo? You say yourself there is nothing to be done there. Everybody is so clean and well off, it makes you quite melancholy. And here you have been so happy going all about Tipton with Mr. Garth into the worst backyards. And now Uncle is abroad, you and Mr. Garth can have it all your own way, and I am sure James does everything you tell him."
"I shall often come here, and I shall see how baby grows all the better," said Dorothea.
"But you will never see him washed," said Celia, "and that is quite the best part of the day."
She was almost pouting. It did seem to her very hard in Dodo to go away from the baby when she might stay.
"Dear Kitty, I will come and stay all night on purpose," said Dorothea. "But I want to be alone now and in my own home. I wish to know the Fairbrothers better, and to talk to Mr. Fairbrother about what there is to be done in Middlemarch."
Dorothea's native strength of will was no longer all converted into resolute submission. She had a great yearning to be at Lowick and was simply determined to go, not feeling bound to tell all her reasons. But everyone around her disapproved. Sir James was much pained, and offered that they should all migrate to Cheltenham for a few months with the sacred ark, otherwise called a cradle. At that period a man could hardly know what to propose if Cheltenham were rejected. The Dowager Lady Chetham, just returned from a visit to her daughter in town, wished at least that Mrs. Vigo should be written to and invited to accept the office of companion to Mrs. Casaubon. It was not credible that Dorothea, as a young widow, would think of living alone in the house at Lowick. Mrs. Vigo had been reader and secretary to royal personages, and in point of knowledge and sentiments, even Dorothea could have nothing to object to her. Mrs. Cadwallader said, privately,
You will certainly go mad in that house alone, my dear. You will see visions. We have all got to exert ourselves a little to keep sane and call things by the same names as other people call them by. To be sure, for younger sons and women who have no money, it is a sort of provision to go mad. They are taken care of then. But you must not run into that. I dare say you are a little bored here with our good dowager, but think what a bore you might become yourself to your fellow creatures if you were always playing tragedy queen and taking things sublimely. Sitting alone in that library at Lowick, you may fancy yourself ruling the weather. You must get a few people round you who wouldn't believe you if you told them. That is a good lowering medicine.
I never called everything by the same name that all the people about me did, said Dorothea stoutly.
But I suppose you have found out your mistake, my dear, said Mrs. Cadwallader, and that is a proof of sanity.
Dorothea was aware of the sting, but it did not hurt her.
No, she said, I still think that the greater part of the world is mistaken about many things. Surely one may be sane and yet think so, since the greater part of the world has often had to come round from its opinion.
Mrs. Cadwallader said no more on that point to Dorothea, but to her husband she remarked,
It will be well for her to marry again as soon as it is proper, if one could get her among the right people. Of course the Chethams would not wish it, but I see clearly a husband is the best thing to keep her in order. If we were not so poor, I would invite Lord Triton. He will be Marquis some day, and there is no denying that she would make a good marchioness. She looks handsomer than ever in her mourning.
My dear Eleanor, do let the poor woman alone. Such contrivances are of no use, said the easy rector.
No use? How are matches made except by bringing men and women together? And it is a shame that her uncle should have run away and shut up the Grange just now. There ought to be plenty of eligible matches invited to Freshit and the Grange. Lord Triton is precisely the man, full of plans for making the people happy in a soft-headed sort of way. That would just suit Mrs. Casaubon.
Let Mrs. Casaubon choose for herself, Eleanor.
That is the nonsense you wise men talk. How can she choose if she has no variety to choose from? A woman's choice usually means taking the only man she can get. Mark my words, Humphrey, if her friends don't exert themselves, there will be a worse business than the Casaubon business yet.
For heaven's sake, don't touch on that topic, Eleanor. It is a very sore point with Sir James. He would be deeply offended if you entered on it to him unnecessarily.
I have never entered on it, said Mrs. Cadwallader, opening her hands. Celia told me all about the will at the beginning, without any asking of mine.
Yes, yes, but they want the thing hushed up, and I understand that the young fellow is going out of the neighbourhood. Mrs. Cadwallader said nothing, but gave her husband three significant nods, with a very sarcastic expression in her dark eyes. Dorothea quietly persisted, in spite of remonstrance and persuasion. So by the end of June, the shutters were all opened at Lowick Manor, and the morning gazed calmly into the library, shining on the rows of notebooks as it shines on the weary waste planted with huge stones, the mute memorial of a forgotten faith. And the evening, laden with roses, entered silently into the blue-green boudoir where Dorothea chose oftenest to sit. At first she walked into every room, questioning the 18 months of her married life, and carrying on her thoughts as if they were a speech to be heard by her husband. Then she lingered in the library, and could not be at rest till she had carefully ranged all the notebooks as she imagined that he would wish to see them, in orderly sequence. The pity, which had been the restraining, compelling motive in her life with him, still clung about his image, even while she remonstrated with him in indignant thought, and told him that he was unjust. One little act of hers may perhaps be smiled at as superstitious. The synoptical tabulation for the use of Mrs. Casaubon she carefully enclosed and sealed, writing within the envelope, I could not use it. Do you not see now that I could not submit my soul to yours by working hopelessly at what I have no belief in? Dorothea. Then she deposited the paper in her own desk. That silent colloquy was perhaps only the more earnest, because underneath and through it all, there was always the deep longing which had really determined her to come to Lowick. The longing was to see Will Ladislaw. She did not know any good that could come of their meeting. She was helpless. Her hands had been tied from making up to him for any unfairness in his lot. But her soul thirsted to see him. How could it be otherwise? If a princess in the days of enchantment had seen a four-footed creature from among those which live in herds come to her once and again with a human gaze which rested upon her with choice and beseeching, what would she think of in her journeying? What would she look for when the herds passed her? Surely for the gaze which had found her, and which she would know again. Life would be no better than candlelight tinsel and daylight rubbish if our spirits were not touched by what has been to issues of longing and constancy. It was true that Dorothea wanted to know the Fairbrothers better, and especially to talk to the new rector, but also true that remembering what Lydgate had told her about Will Ladislaw and little Miss Noble, she counted on Will's coming to Lowick to see the Fairbrother family. The very first Sunday before she entered the church, she saw him as she had seen him the last time she was there, alone in the clergyman's pew. But when she entered, his figure was gone. In the weekdays when she went to see the ladies at the rectory, she listened in vain for some word that they might fall about Will. But it seemed to her that Mrs. Fairbrother talked of everyone else in the neighbourhood and out of it. "Probably some of Mr. Fairbrother's Middlemarch hearers may follow him to Lowick sometimes. Do you not think so?" said Dorothea, rather despising herself for having a secret motive in asking the question. "If they are wise, they will, Mrs. Casaubon," said the old lady. "I see that you set a right value on my son's breeching. His grandfather on my side was an excellent clergyman, but his father was in the law, most exemplary and honest nevertheless, which is a reason for our never being rich. They say fortune is a woman and capricious, but sometimes she is a good woman and gives to those who merit, which has been the case with you, Mrs. Casaubon, who have given a living to my son." Mrs. Fairbrother recurred to her knitting with a dignified satisfaction in her neat little effort at oratory. But this was not what Dorothea wanted to hear. Poor thing! She did not even know whether Will Ladislaw was still at Middlemarch, and there was no one whom she dared to ask, unless it were Lydgate. But just now she could not see Lydgate without sending for him or going to seek him. Perhaps Will Ladislaw, having heard of that strange ban against him left by Mr. Casaubon, had felt it better that he and she should not meet again, and perhaps she was wrong to wish for a meeting that others might find many good reasons against. "Still, I do wish it," came at the end of those wise reflections as naturally as a sob after holding the breath. And the meeting did happen, but in a formal way quite unexpected by her. One morning, about 11, Dorothea was seated in her boudoir with a map of the land attached to the manor, and other papers before her, which were to help her in making an exact statement for herself of her income and affairs. She had not yet applied herself to her work, but was seated with her hands folded on her lap, looking out along the avenue of limes to the distant fields. Every leaf was at rest in the sunshine. The familiar scene was changeless, and seemed to represent the prospect of her life, full of motiveless ease. Motiveless if her own energy could not seek out reasons for ardent action. The widow's cap of those times made an oval frame for the face, and had a crown standing up. The dress was an experiment in the utmost laying on of crape, but this heavy solemnity of clothing made her face look all the younger, with its recovered bloom and the sweet inquiring candour of her eyes. Her reverie was broken by Tantripp, who came to say that Mr. Ladislaw was below, and begged permission to see Madam if it were not too early. "I will see him," said Dorothea, rising immediately. "Let him be shown into the drawing-room." The drawing-room was the most neutral room in the house to her, the one least associated with the trials of her married life. The damask matched the woodwork, which was all white and gold. There were two tall mirrors and tables with nothing on them. In brief, it was a room where you had no reason for sitting in one place rather than in another, It was below the boudoir, and had also a bow window looking out on the avenue. But when Pratt showed Will Ladislaw into it, the window was open, and a winged visitor buzzing in and out now and then without minding the furniture made the room look less formal and uninhabited.
"Glad to see you here again, sir," said Pratt, lingering to adjust a blind.
"I am only come to say goodbye, Pratt," said Will, who wished even the butler to know that he was too proud to hang about Mrs. Casaubon, now she was a rich widow.
"Very sorry to hear it, sir," said Pratt, retiring.
Of course, as a servant who was to be told nothing, he knew the fact of which Ladislaw was still ignorant, and had drawn his inferences, indeed, had not differed from his betrothed, Tantrip, when she said, "Your master was as jealous as a fiend, and no reason. Madam would look higher than Mr. Ladislaw, else I don't know her. Mrs. Cadwallader's maid says there's a lord coming who is to marry her when the morning's over." There were not many moments for Will to walk about with his hat in his hand before Dorothea entered. The meeting was very different from that first meeting in Rome, when Will had been embarrassed and Dorothea calm. This time he felt miserable but determined, while she was in a state of agitation which could not be hidden. Just outside the door, she had felt that this longed-for meeting was after all too difficult, and when she saw Will advancing towards her, the deep blush which was rare in her came with painful suddenness. Neither of them knew how it was, but neither of them spoke. She gave her hand for a moment, and then they went to sit down near the window, she on one settee and he on another opposite. Will was peculiarly uneasy. It seemed to him not like Dorothea that the mere fact of her being a widow should cause such a change in her manner of receiving him, and he knew of no other condition which could have affected their previous relation to each other, except that, as his imagination at once told him, her friends might have been poisoning her mind with their suspicions of him. "I hope I have not presumed too much in calling," said Will. "I could not bear to leave the neighbourhood and begin a new life without seeing you to say goodbye."
"Presumed? Surely not. I should have thought it unkind if you had not wished to see me," said Dorothea, her habit of speaking with perfect genuineness asserting itself through all her uncertainty and agitation. "Are you going away immediately?"
"Very soon, I think. I intend to go to town and eat my dinners as a barrister, since, they say, that is the preparation for all public business. There will be a great deal of political work to be done by and by, and I mean to try and do some of it. Other men have managed to win an honourable position for themselves without family or money."
"And that will make it all the more honourable," said Dorothea ardently. "Besides, you have so many talents. I have heard from my uncle how well you speak in public, so that everyone is sorry when you leave off, and how clearly you can explain things. And you care that justice should be done to everyone. I am so glad. When we were in Rome, I thought you only cared for poetry and art and the things that adorn life for us who are well off. But now I know you think about the rest of the world."
While she was speaking, Dorothea had lost her personal embarrassment and had become like her former self. She looked at Will with a direct glance, full of delighted confidence.
"You approve of my going away for years, then, and never coming here again till I have made myself of some mark in the world?" said Will,
trying hard to reconcile the utmost pride with the utmost effort to get an expression of strong feeling from Dorothea. She was not aware how long it was before she answered. She had turned her head and was looking out of the window on the rose bushes, which seemed to have in them the summers of all the years when Will would be away. This was not judicious behaviour, but Dorothea never thought of studying her manners. She thought only of bowing to a sad necessity which divided her from Will. Those first words of his about his intentions had seemed to make everything clear to her. He knew, she supposed, all about Mr. Casaubon's final conduct in relation to him, and it had come to him with the same sort of shock as to herself. He had never felt more than friendship for her, had never had anything in his mind to justify what she felt to be her husband's outrage on the feelings of both, and that friendship he still felt. Something which may be called an inward silent sob had gone on in Dorothea before she said, with a pure voice, just trembling in the last words, as if only from its liquid flexibility.
Yes, it must be right for you to do as you say. I shall be very happy when I hear that you have made your value felt. But you must have patience. It will perhaps be a long while.
Will never quite knew how it was that he saved himself from falling down at her feet when the long while came forth with its gentle tremor. He used to say that the horrible hue and surface of her crepe dress was most likely the sufficient controlling force. He sat still, however, and only said, "I shall never hear from you, and you will forget all about me."
"No," said Dorothea, "I shall never forget you. I have never forgotten anyone whom I once knew. My life has never been crowded, and seems not likely to be so. And I have a great deal of space for memory at Lowick, haven't I?"
She smiled.
"Good God!"
Will burst out passionately, rising with his hat still in his hand, and walking to a marble table where he suddenly turned and leaned his back against it. The blood had mounted to his face and neck, and he looked almost angry. It had seemed to him as if they were like two creatures slowly turning to marble in each other's presence, while their hearts were conscious and their eyes were yearning. But there was no help for it. It should never be true of him that in this meeting to which he had come with bitter resolution, he had ended by a confession which might be interpreted into asking for her fortune. Moreover, it was actually true that he was fearful of the effect which such confessions might have on Dorothea herself. She looked at him from that distance in some trouble, imagining that there might have been an offence in her words. But all the while, there was a current of thought in her about his probable want of money, and the impossibility of her helping him. If her uncle had been at home, something might have been done through him. It was this preoccupation with the hardship of Will's wanting money, while she had what ought to have been his share, which led her to say, seeing that he remained silent and looked away from her,
"I wonder whether you would like to have that miniature which hangs upstairs. I mean, that beautiful miniature of your grandmother. I think it is not right for me to keep it, if you would wish to have it. It is wonderfully like you."
"You are very good," said Will irritably. "No, I don't mind about it. It is not very consoling to have one's own likeness. It would be more consoling if others wanted to have it."
"I thought you would like to cherish her memory. I thought—"
Dorothea broke off in an instant, her imagination suddenly warning her away from Aunt Julia's history.
"You would surely like to have the miniature as a family memorial."
"Why should I have that when I have nothing else? A man with only a portmanteau for his stowage must keep his memorials in his head."
Will spoke at random. He was merely venting his petulance. It was a little too exasperating to have his grandmother's portrait offered him at that moment. But to Dorothea's feeling his words had a peculiar sting. She rose and said with a touch of indignation as well as hauteur,
"You are much the happier of us two, Mr. Ladislaw, to have nothing."
Will was startled. Whatever the words might be, the tone seemed like a dismissal, and quitting his leaning posture he walked a little way towards her. Their eyes met, but with a strange, questioning gravity. Something was keeping their minds aloof, and each was left to conjecture what was in the other. Will had never really thought of himself as having a claim of inheritance on the property which was held by Dorothea, and would have required a narrative to make him understand her present feeling. "I never felt it a misfortune to have nothing till now," he said. "But poverty may be as bad as leprosy if it divides us from what we most care for." The words cut Dorothea to the heart and made her relent. She answered in a tone of sad fellowship,
"Sorrow comes in so many ways. 2 years ago, I had no notion of that. I mean of the unexpected way in which trouble comes and ties our hands and makes us silent when we long to speak. I used to despise women a little for not shaping their lives more and doing better things. I was very fond of doing as I liked. But I have almost given it up," she ended, smiling playfully.
"I have not given up doing as I like, but I can very seldom do it," said Will.
He was standing 2 yards from her, with his mind full of contradictory desires and resolves, desiring some unmistakable proof that she loved him, and yet dreading the position into which such a proof might bring him. The thing one most longs for may be surrounded with conditions that would be intolerable. At this moment, Pratt entered and said, "Sir James Chettam is in the library, madam." "Ask Sir James to come in here," said Dorothea immediately. It was as if the same electric shock had passed through her and Will. Each of them felt proudly resistant, and neither looked at the other while they awaited Sir James's entrance. After shaking hands with Dorothea, he bowed as slightly as possible to Ladislaw, who repaid the slightness exactly, and then, going towards Dorothea, said, "I must say goodbye, Mrs. Casaubon, and probably for a long while." Dorothea put out her hand and said her goodbye cordially. The sense that Sir James was depreciating Will and behaving rudely to him roused her resolution and dignity. There was no touch of confusion in her manner. And when Will had left the room, she looked with such calm self-possession at Sir James, saying, "How is Celia?" that he was obliged to behave as if nothing had annoyed him. And what would be the use of behaving otherwise? Indeed, Sir James shrank with so much dislike from the association, even in thought, of Dorothea with Ladislaw as her possible lover, that he would himself have wished to avoid an outward show of displeasure which would have recognised the disagreeable possibility. If anyone had asked him why he shrank in that way, I am not sure that he would at first have said anything fuller or more precise than, "That Ladislaw!" Though on reflection, he might have urged that Mr. Casaubon's codicil, barring Dorothea's marriage with Will except under a penalty, was enough to cast unfitness over any relation at all between them. His aversion was all the stronger because he felt himself unable to interfere. But Sir James was a power in a way unguessed by himself. Entering at that moment, he was an incorporation of the strongest reasons through which Will's pride became a repellent force, keeping him asunder from Dorothea. Chapter 55. If youth is the season of hope, it is often so only in the sense that our elders are hopeful about us. For no age is so apt as youth to think its emotions, partings, and resolves are the last of their kind. Each crisis seems final, simply because it is new. We are told that the oldest inhabitants in Peru do not cease to be agitated by the earthquakes, but they probably see beyond each shock and reflect that there are plenty more to come. To Dorothea, still in that time of youth when the eyes, with their long, full lashes, look out after their rain of tears unsoiled and unwearied as a freshly opened passion flower, that morning's parting with Will Ladislaw seemed to be the close of their personal relations. He was going away into the distance of unknown years, and if ever he came back, he would be another man. The actual state of his mind, his proud resolve to give the lie beforehand to any suspicion that he would play the needy adventurer seeking a rich woman, lay quite out of her imagination, and she had interpreted all his behaviour easily enough by her supposition that Mr. Casaubon's codicil seemed to him as it did to her, a gross and cruel interdict on any active friendship between them. Their young delight in speaking to each other and saying what no one else would care to hear was forever ended and become a treasure of the past. For this very reason, she dwelt on it without inward check. That unique happiness, too, was dead, and in its shadowed, silent chamber she might vent the passionate grief which she herself wondered at. For the first time, she took down the miniature from the wall and kept it before her, liking to blend the woman who had been too hardly judged with the grandson whom her own heart and judgment defended. Can anyone who has rejoiced in woman's tenderness think it a reproach to her that she took the little oval picture in her palm and made a bed for it there, and leaned her cheek upon it, as if that would soothe the creature who had suffered unjust condemnation? She did not know then that it was love who had come to her briefly as in a dream before awaking, with the hues of morning on his wings. that it was love to whom she was sobbing her farewell, as his image was banished by the blameless rigour of irresistible day. She only felt that there was something irrevocably amiss and lost in her lot, and her thoughts about the future were the more readily shapen into resolve. Ardent souls, ready to construct their coming lives, are apt to commit themselves to the fulfilment of their own visions. One day that she went to Freshitt to fulfil her promise of staying all night and seeing baby washed, Mrs. Cadwallader came to dine, the rector being gone on a fishing excursion. It was a warm evening, and even in the delightful drawing-room, where the fine old turf sloped from the open window towards a lilied pool and well-planted mounds, the heat was enough to make Celia, in her white muslin and light curls, reflect with pity on what Dodo must feel in her black dress and close cap. But this was not until some episodes with baby were over and had left her mind at leisure. She had seated herself and taken up a fan for some time before she said in her quiet guttural,
"Dear Dodo, do throw off that cap. I am sure your dress must make you feel ill."
"I am so used to the cap. It has become a sort of shell," said Dorothea, smiling. "I feel rather bare and exposed when it is off."
"I must see you without it. It makes us all warm," said Celia, throwing down her fan and going to Dorothea.
It was a pretty picture to see this little lady in white muslin unfastening the widow's cap from her more majestic sister and tossing it onto a chair. Just as the coils and braids of dark brown hair had been set free, Sir James entered the room. He looked at the released head and said, "Ah," in a tone of satisfaction.
"It was I who did it, James," said Celia. "Dodo need not make such a slavery of her mourning. She need not wear that cap any more among her friends."
"My dear Celia," said Lady Chetham, "a widow must wear her mourning at least a year."
"Not if she marries again before the end of it," said Mrs. Cadwallader,
who had some pleasure in startling her good friend the Dowager. Sir James was annoyed, and leaned forward to play with Celia's Maltese dog.
"That is very rare, I hope," said Lady Chetham, in a tone intended to guard against such events. "No friend of ours ever committed herself in that way, except Mrs. Beevor, and it was very painful to Lord Grinsell when she did so. Her first husband was objectionable, which made it the greater wonder, and severely she was punished for it. They said Captain Beevor dragged her about by the hair and held up loaded pistols at her."
"Oh, if she took the wrong man," said Mrs. Cadwallader,
who was in a decidedly wicked mood.
"Marriage is always bad then, first or second. Priority is a poor recommendation in a husband if he has got no other. I would rather have a good second husband than an indifferent first."
"My dear, your clever tongue runs away with you," said Lady Chetham. "I am sure you would be the last woman to marry again prematurely if our dear rector were taken away."
"Oh, I make no vows. It might be a necessary economy. It is lawful to marry again, I suppose, else we might as well be Hindus instead of Christians. Of course, if a woman accepts the wrong man, she must take the consequences, and one who does it twice over deserves her fate. But if she can marry blood, beauty, and bravery, the sooner the better."
"I think the subject of our conversation is very ill chosen," said Sir James, with a look of disgust. "Suppose we change it."
"Not on my account, Sir James," said Dorothea, determined not to lose the opportunity of freeing herself from certain oblique references to excellent matches. "If you are speaking on my behalf, I can assure you that no question can be more indifferent and impersonal to me than second marriage. It is no more to me than if you talked of women going fox-hunting. Whether it is admirable in them or not, I shall not follow them. Pray let Mrs. Cadwallader amuse herself on that subject as much as on any other."
"My dear Mrs. Casaubon," said Lady Chetham in her stateliest way,
"you do not, I hope, think there was any allusion to you in my mentioning Mrs. Beevor. It was only an instance that occurred to me. She was stepdaughter to Lord Grinsell. He married Mrs. Teveroy for his second wife.
there could be no possible allusion to you.
Oh, no, said Celia. Nobody chose the subject. It all came out of Dodo's cap. Mrs. Cadwallader only said what was quite true. A woman could not be married in a widow's cap, James.
Hush, my dear, said Mrs. Cadwallader. I will not offend again. I will not even refer to Dido or Zenobia. Only what are we to talk about? I, for my part, object to the discussion of human nature, because that is the nature of rectors' wives. Later in the evening, after Mrs. Cadwallader was gone, Celia said privately to Dorothea,
Really, Dodo, taking your cap off made you like yourself again in more ways than one. You spoke up just as you used to do when anything was said to displease you. But I could hardly make out whether it was James that you thought wrong, or Mrs. Cadwallader.
Neither, said Dorothea. James spoke out of delicacy to me. But he was mistaken in supposing that I minded what Mrs. Cadwallader said. I should only mind if there were a law obliging me to take any piece of blood and beauty that she or anybody else recommended.
But you know, Dodo, if you ever did marry, it would be all the better to have blood and beauty, said Celia, reflecting that Mr. Casaubon had not been richly endowed with those gifts, and that it would be well to caution Dorothea in time.
Don't be anxious, Kitty. I have quite other thoughts about my life. I shall never marry again, said Dorothea, touching her sister's chin and looking at her with indulgent affection. Celia was nursing her baby, and Dorothea had come to say good night to her.
Really? Quite? Said Celia. Not anybody at all, if he were very wonderful indeed.
Dorothea shook her head slowly. Not anybody at all. I have delightful plans. I should like to take a great deal of land and drain it, and make a little colony where everybody should work and all the work should be done well. I should know every one of the people and be their friend. I am going to have great consultations with Mr. Garth. He can tell me almost everything I want to know.
Then you will be happy if you have a plan, Dodo, said Celia. Perhaps little Arthur will like plans when he grows up, and then he can help you.
Sir James was informed that same night that Dorothea was really quite set against marrying anybody at all, and was going to take to all sorts of plans just like what she used to have. Sir James made no remark. To his secret feeling, there was something repulsive in a woman's second marriage, and no match would prevent him from feeling it a sort of desecration for Dorothea. He was aware that the world would regard such a sentiment as preposterous, especially in relation to a woman of 21, the practice of the world being to treat of a young widow's second marriage as certain and probably near, and to smile with meaning if the widow acts accordingly. But if Dorothea did choose to espouse her solitude, he felt that the resolution would well become her. Chapter 56. Dorothea's confidence in Caleb Garth's knowledge, which had begun on her hearing that he approved of her cottages, had grown fast during her stay at Freshet, Sir James having induced her to take rides over the two estates in company with himself and Caleb, who quite returned her admiration, and told his wife that Mrs. Casaubon had a head for business most uncommon in a woman. It must be remembered that by business, Caleb never meant money transactions, but the skilful application of labour. "Most uncommon," repeated Caleb. "She said a thing I often used to think myself when I was a lad. Mr. Garth, I should like to feel, if I lived to be old, that I had improved a great piece of land and built a great many good cottages, because the work is of a healthy kind while it is being done, and after it is done, men are the better for it." Those were the very words. She sees into things in that way. "But womanly, I hope," said Mrs. Garth, half suspecting that Mrs. Casaubon might not hold the true principle of subordination. "Oh, you can't think," said Caleb, shaking his head. "You would like to hear her speak, Susan. She speaks in such plain words and a voice like music. Bless me, it reminds me of bits in The Messiah.
And straightway there appeared a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, It has a tone with it that satisfies your ear.
Caleb was very fond of music, and when he could afford it, went to hear an oratorio that came within his reach, returning from it with a profound reverence for this mighty structure of tones, which made him sit meditatively, looking on the floor, and throwing much unutterable language into his outstretched hands. With this good understanding between them, it was natural that Dorothea asked Mr. Garth to undertake any business connected with the three farms and the numerous tenements attached to Lowick Manor. Indeed, his expectation of getting work for two was being fast fulfilled. As he said, business breeds. And one form of business which was beginning to breed just then was the construction of railways. A projected line was to run through Lowick Parish, where the cattle had hitherto grazed in a peace unbroken by astonishment. And thus it happened that the infant struggles of the railway system entered into the affairs of Caleb Garth, and determined the course of this history with regard to two persons who were dear to him. The submarine railway may have its difficulties, but the bed of the sea is not divided among various landed proprietors with claims for damages not only measurable but sentimental. In the hundred to which Middlemarch belonged, railways were as exciting a topic as the Reform Bill or the imminent horrors of cholera, and those who held the most decided views on the subject were women and landholders. Women, both old and young, regarded travelling by steam as presumptuous and dangerous, and argued against it by saying that nothing should induce them to get into a railway carriage, while proprietors, differing from each other in their arguments as much as Mr. Solomon Featherstone differed from Lord Medlicott, were yet unanimous in the opinion that in selling land, whether to the enemy of mankind or to a company obliged to purchase, these pernicious agencies must be made to pay a very high price to landowners for permission to injure mankind. But the slower wits, such as Mr. Solomon and Mrs. Wall, who both occupied land of their own, took a long time to arrive at this conclusion, their minds halting at the vivid conception of what it would be to cut the big pasture in two and turn it into three-cornered bits, which would be know-how, while accommodation bridges and high payments were remote and incredible.
"The cows will all cast their calves, brother," said Mrs. Wall in a tone of deep melancholy. "If the railway comes across the near close, and I shouldn't wonder at the mare, too, if she was in foal. It's a poor tale if a widow's property is to be spaded away and the law say nothing to it. What's to hinder 'em from cutting right and left if they begin? It's well known I can't fight."
"The best way would be to say nothing and set somebody on to send 'em away with a flea in their ear when they came spying and measuring," said Solomon. "Folks did that about brassing, by what I can understand. It's all a pretense if the truth was known about their being forced to take one way. Let 'em go cutting in another parish. And I don't believe in any pay to make amends for bringing a lot of ruffians to trample your crops. Where's a company's pocket?"
"Brother Peter, God forgive him, got money out of a company," said Mrs. Wall. "But that was for the manganese. That wasn't for railways to blow you to pieces right and left."
"Well, there's this to be said, Jane," Mr. Solomon concluded, lowering his voice in a cautious manner. "The more spokes we put in their wheel, the more they'll pay us to let 'em go on, if they must come, whether or not."
This reasoning of Mr. Solomon's was perhaps less thorough than he imagined, his cunning bearing about the same relation to the course of railways as the cunning of a diplomatist bears to the general chill or catarrh of the solar system. But he set about acting on his views in a thoroughly diplomatic manner, by stimulating suspicion. His side of Lowick was the most remote from the village, and the houses of the labouring people were either lone cottages or were collected in a hamlet called Frick, where a watermill and some stone pits made a little centre of slow, heavy-shouldered industry. In the absence of any precise idea as to what railways were, public opinion in Frick was against them, for the human mind in that grassy corner had not the proverbial tendency to admire the unknown, holding rather that it was likely to be against the poor man, and that suspicion was the only wise attitude with regard to it. Even the rumour of reform had not yet excited any millennial expectations in Frick, there being no definite promise in it, as of gratuitous grains to fatten Hiram Ford's pig, or of a publican at the Weights and Scales who would brew beer for nothing, or of an offer on the part of the three neighbouring farmers to raise wages during winter. And without distinct good of this kind in its promises, reform seemed on a footing with the bragging of peddlers, which was a hint for distrust to every knowing person. The men of Frick were not ill-fed, and were less given to fanaticism than to a strong, muscular suspicion, less inclined to believe that they were peculiarly cared for by heaven than to regard heaven itself as rather disposed to take them in, a disposition observable in the weather.
End of Disc 17.